Okay, so welcome for computer graphics, and as a reminder, or new message for those who were not here on Tuesday, so next Tuesday, December 3rd, I think it should be, there will be no computer graphics lecture, okay? And we will compensate that by having two Thursday lectures which are 90 minutes instead of 45. Yeah, so next Tuesday, no lecture. Okay, good. So we on last Tuesday we were speaking about occlusion, visibility, and transparency. And transparency is an interesting topic because as I told you or showed you last time, it makes things more difficult. Transparency does not work together with a set buffer. So we explicitly have to take care of that. And in standard renderings, like OpenGL or so, for instance, we do not have a simple option that says enable transparency, and we can then render transparent objects, but we have to really have to take care and look at that when doing rendering. And there are two reasons why transparency is difficult. So the first one, that's just a repetition from last time. Yeah, the first thing is that alpha blending is not commutative. Alpha blending means you combine when setting a pixel, you combine. You do not just override that pixel with a new color, but you combine the old color with a new color, and it's a linear combination. And this linear combination value is alpha, or alpha controls that linear combination, and that can be interpreted as a transparency, or in fact, it's the other way around. It's the opposite of transparency. That's what we call opacity. And by this, transparency can be achieved, but transparency is not, or this alpha blending is not commutative. That means if I first render a red object and then a transparent green one on top, it's different than if I first render. Or no, the other way around. If I first render a green object and then a red transparent on top, it's different from first rendering a red one and then a green on top. Yeah, that's different. It makes a difference whether I have a green glass in front of a red glass or the other way around. And we have to take care of the order. And the second effect, transparent objects and the set buffer don't work together. So if I have two transparent objects behind each other, and I first render the frontmost, the first one with set buffer enabled, the result will be that the one behind will be hidden. This is what we do not want. Yeah, we see the second object behind the first one. We want to see that. Yeah, the first one should be sort of transparent. Okay, so the set buffer doesn't work in that case. And essentially, that means we have to take care of that. And the typical solution for that is what we called here approach B. So we first render all the opaque objects with a set buffer. For these objects, the set buffer works fine. We don't have to sort. And usually, the majority of the objects in a scene is opaque, so it's not transparent. And then we finally look at the transparent, at the hopefully few transparent objects. We render them from back to front, and so that the alpha blending works in the right way, so that we get correct values. Yeah, now we have to look how we handle the set buffer. And in fact, what we do is that we still use the set buffer for occlusion tests. Yeah, so if there's an opaque object, a wall, and behind there's a transparent object, we don't want to see it. But when we render the transparent objects, we sort of freeze the set buffer. That means we don't set new values. I mean, if we really sort the transparent objects back to front, then we don't need to freeze the set buffer, then it will always be overwritten. Then it doesn't make a big difference. An alternative is to freeze the set buffer and just to render the transparent objects in the order they come, and to allow that results are wrong because the order might be wrong. But the second one is very fast, and this one delivers right results. Okay, Good. Yeah, so that was our state last time. So if we want to render transparent objects, we have to kind of sort them out and handle them separately. Okay, good. But ideally, we would like to avoid that. And transparent objects can really contribute and can look very nice and can be interesting. So now in the following, I would like to describe two more advanced approaches for transparency rendering. And these are called depth peeling and per pixel linked lists. And the idea is that these are methods to correctly render transparent objects without explicitly doing object sorting and stuff like that. Yeah? And so the first one is called depth peeling, and the second one per pixel linked lists. And yeah, depth peeling is an interesting approach that is based on the following idea. So look at, maybe this picture already explains most of the idea. So look at this cup here, this image. Yeah, this is a three-dimensional image of such a cup. And due to the set buffer, what we see are only the frontmost surfaces per pixel. So in every pixel, we know the first intersection with that surface. Yeah, that's the typical rendering that we get when we use set buffer. Now, what we could do is that we render, if we have that set buffer, that we render the scene for a second time. And that time, now we throw away all these fragments that we see here. Yeah, so we keep that set buffer, and we render, so we keep it somewhere, we store it somewhere off to another texture or wherever. And then we render the very same scene again. Yeah? But now we discard all fragments that have already been seen here. Yeah? So whenever, we could do that in a fragment shader, for instance. Whenever we want to render a pixel, we first look whether this is the pixel that we already saw here. This is just a depth comparison. Yeah? We compare the depth with the depth that has been set here. And if this is the case, we throw that pixel away, that fragment. Yeah? So what will happen is that the kind of second layer of that image becomes visible. Yeah? Now we see all the parts of this object that are seen as second intersection from the image. Yeah? And of course, now we can continue that. We can keep this one. And here now we throw away all fragments that have been seen here or here. We can do that by a simple comparison and throw away everything that is closer to the camera than it was in the previous frame. So we throw away these, and this gives us these few fragments. And in the fourth pass, we will see that the image is black, so now no objects remain, no pixels remain. That means this rendering here essentially has three layers, three depth layers. Okay, so this rendering here now has been generated by rendering the scene three times. In fact, we need to render four times to find out that the fourth image is empty and that we are done. And now for every single pixel, the nice thing is by looking into these consecutive images, we do not only see the frontmost point, yeah, but we see all the points which are visible in that pixel. And we even see them sorted from front to back. And that's exactly what we want to have for our transparency rendering. Yeah? Because for transparency rendering, per pixel we want to know, okay, we intersect this surface, it has this color, it has this alpha value, then comes this surface with this color and this alpha value, and so on. So essentially, we can take now these images and blend them from back to front. Yeah, always take this layer, blend it onto this one, and then take this layer, blend it onto this one, onto the previously two blended ones. And this gives us the correct result. Yeah? So the sorting back to front is not done on a per object basis by sorting the single objects. But instead, we decompose our object into separate layers, and blend then these layers back to front again. Yeah? And such a data structure here is called a layered depth image. It's a sequence of images, and each image contains a depth layer of the scene. Rendering these depth layers is rather simple, but yeah, it really requires, if you have your scene consists of n depth layers, you need to render the scene n times. And this example is a very simple one, but if you look at, for instance, a tree or something more complex, we will see much more complex objects later on. Yeah, it can easily happen that you have something like maybe 100 of these depth layers, and then of course this approach becomes very wasteful. Yeah, you need to render many, many times to peel off one layer after the other, and things become quite costly. But for such simple objects, this works just fine. You don't need to differentiate between opaque and transparent objects. The only thing that you need to do is that with these images, with every pixel, you do not only need to store the color, but also the alpha value. Yeah? So when storing all these images also contain an alpha value. I mean, that object is not transparent, so it's a bad example. But you just need to store the alpha value, and then we can do the blending back to front. Okay, so here another example. So that's a artificial scene, and we look at that scene from the left. So you see here the x-axis is depth. Depth goes from left to right, so we're looking from the left onto that scene. And now you see level zero are, so we're looking with an orthogonal camera, so all the view rays are parallel here, and you see here in the top, here we see nothing. Here also the first layer, or the zeroth layer, is empty. Then here we see this part of the object, then we see this, and then this, and if this layer is peeled off and we render again, we next see this, and if this one is peeled off, what remains is this, and then we are done. Yeah, so we have three depth layers in this example. Okay, and this now for a really transparent and a slightly bit more complicated object. So this teapot here, I mean, it uses false colors. And in fact, I cannot remember what these false colors show. Probably it's just that the teapot is green inside. Yeah. Okay, so in the first layer, or in layer zero, that's the normal set buffer rendering. And now imagine, yeah, that you just remove everything of the scene that you see here. So in the next layer, you can look into the teapot. Yeah, you see the inside of the teapot. That's why the perspective looks a bit strange here. And if you peel off that one, what you see here now is the background plane. Yeah, so part of the background plane is already here, because here it's in the first layer, and that part behind the teapot is here in the third, or in the second layer. Yeah? And then the third layer still contains some parts that's here because of the sprout of the teapot. And there would even be a fourth, and I'm not sure. So there's already part of the sprout. So maybe that's already the last layer. But it could be that there are still a few scattered points in the fourth layer. Yeah? Now we decomposed our scene into different layers. And now we can blend these together again. Yeah? So here we have the first layer. And if we blend on top, or if we take the second layer and blend on top the first one, we always have to do that from back to front. So if we take the first two layers, we see this image. That's a bit different from that one. Yeah? There are additional spheres and so inside to see the effect. Then we see this one. So we see already a few spheres in the teapot, inside the teapot. Yeah? So the teapot is transparent. Then we take the third layer. Now we can look at the differences. The differences become, there are not too many differences from here to here anymore. So you see usually with rather few layers, the result is already okay. Does anybody see a difference from here to here? Ah, yeah, exactly, here. Here. This one is missing, and here it reappears. And in fact, here it's only the front layer, and here also the back one will happen. I mean, we can directly look at that, yeah? And yeah, probably also inside the teapot, it gets a bit more bluish from here to here, because now the background becomes visible through the teapot. Yeah, that was not visible here. So here it's a bit more bluish than here. I mean, we can just look at these differences. And if we also include that one, it's mainly here, the sprout, and also here the rim, where differences, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's already, I would say, negligible. Okay, good. Yeah, so it's a very simple technique. Can be implemented quickly. It mainly requires to write such a shader that discards fragments, and you have to always take, after one rendering, take the set buffer, write it off to somewhere, to some place, so that in the next render pass you can access the previous depth buffer and use that for the depth test, or use that for throwing away fragments. But that's pretty simple. The major disadvantage: if your scene has high depth complexity, things become very slow. But on the other hand, as we also see here, typically it's just okay to use the frontmost k layers, where k is a rather small number. Yeah, so it's also acceptable just to peel off the first few layers and then take these. That's typically fine. But nevertheless, it means to render the scene k times. Okay, so that's a widely and often used solution. You cannot only use that for transparency. It's also often very interesting to really have the entire information of a pixel, which fragments end up in a pixel. Yeah? Yes, that's true. As soon as one image becomes empty, you don't need to render further ones. Is that what you meant?
Yes.
Yes, that's true. And your observation is also right, is interesting, because so imagine you have a large scene which doesn't have horrible depth complexity, but there's a little tree object inside that scene. So that little tree, which only covers maybe a few pixels, has very high depth complexity. So if you want to generate a full layer depth image, yeah, you have to render the entire scene very, very often, just to peel off all the layers of that very small part of that tree. Yeah? So if the depth complexity is very uneven, then this algorithm really has runs in trouble, because all these render passes become expensive. And that's a good motivation for the second method I want to speak about, and that's per pixel linked lists. And here the idea is, essentially the title says it all. So ideally what we would like to have is the following. Whenever we render an object, so this is our screen. Now, whenever we render an object, a triangle, our rasterizer determines which pixels are covered by that object. And then it calls a pixel shader for these generated pixels. And in this pixel shader, it's a piece of code. And in there, you can typically compute the color of that point. Yeah, you can do the shading. That's the standard application. And after that, and really after that in the standard pipeline, after that, the depth comparison is done. Yeah, so after that, it is determined whether this pixel is visible. And if it's not visible, if it's occluded by a by a smaller set value in front, then this pixel is thrown away. But nevertheless, that means all triangles that cover a particular pixel, for all these triangles, the pixel shader is called at that particular position. Yeah? And essentially what we want per pixel is that we just want to know for that pixel a list of all the triangles, yeah, that have hit this pixel. In the final image, you only see the frontmost. Yeah? But during that shading, all these triangles at this pixel position, yeah, processing happens. So in that phase, we have all that information that we want for shading, for transparency computation. Yeah? We know when rendering this cup here, yeah, in the final image, we only see the frontmost, but also here, for this backside or for the inside of the cup, here also a pixel shader has been called, and also here, it's just the result didn't show up in the final image. So ideally, what we would like to have is that whenever such a pixel shader is called, we store with that pixel the information, okay, this triangle number, whatever, 1132, covers this pixel. Yeah? And we want to store that per pixel, that means per pixel, but we don't know how many of these triangles will end up in that pixel, so ideally we would like to have a list per pixel. Yeah? So per pixel we would like to have a list, and that tells us, okay, now triangle 1132 covers that pixel, 4711, and whatever, triangle 42, and that's it. Yeah? And for this pixel, we would also like to have such a list. And for each of these pixels, we would like to have such a list. And so this is the first pass. And then in the second pass, for every pixel, we can take all these points, sort them by depth, and do the blending. Yeah? So that means we would do that sorting explicitly per pixel and then do the blending again. Okay, now doing such links here in a fragment shader. I mean, if you already programmed such fragment shaders in the programming tutorials, you know that this is highly parallel and stuff like that. Yeah, and you have to be very careful because, for instance, it can easily happen that two triangles or even more cover the same pixel and that they work on the same pixel in parallel. Yeah? So many processes can try to insert information into that particular pixel, for instance. Yeah? And they need synchronization and stuff like that you learned about in other lectures. Yeah? So that's not that simple. So the idea is simple, but really making this work on parallel GPUs in that case, is difficult. If you have an offline rendering system, that's simple. Yeah, I hope you are able to implement such a linked list and are able to add new entries and so on. But doing that interactively with OpenGL is tricky, but in fact, it was in not very long ago, since 2 or 3 years, OpenGL is flexible enough to support that. In fact, I won't go into details how this is done, because that's still quite involved, and you need very weird OpenGL extensions and so on. But what you can achieve is something like this here, and this is kind of corresponds to this image. You can generate a data structure where for every pixel, so these are the pixels of an image, in fact, of course, they are 2D. And for each of these pixels, now in a frame buffer, you typically have simply one color. Yeah? So that's why you can store it in an array. But now, for each pixel, we store a list of entries, yeah? A list of colors. And these are all the depth layers that have been visible in that pixel. So for every pixel, we store all the depth layers that were that were visible in such a linked list. So essentially that means we render this cup once here, yeah, and in this one pass, for each of these pixels, all these layers here are generated within one single pass. Yeah? And in the end, we have such a data structure. Yeah? For every pixel, we know such a complete list of fragments. Okay, now, as I said, this is really a bit simplified. Things are complicated, but or a bit more complicated. But yeah, in fact, it is possible this way. Yeah, and this is what we need for order-independent transparency, for computing transparency, because now we can take these lists. We can simply sort all these depth layers by their depth, yeah, from back to front. And we can do, for every pixel, we can go through this list, sort it, do the blending, and this gives us the color of that pixel. Yeah? So we need a first pass to generate this, and then a second pass to sort the list and to sum up, to blend the values, and then we have correct values for that particular pixel. Yeah? So we do not have these many passes that we need here. We only have one rendering pass. This is more complicated, yeah, because this list handling is more complicated. We have to take care about synchronization and stuff like that. But within one rendering pass, we have all the information, all these layers, and can then do the blending in a second pass. Okay. Yeah. So two passes. First, render the scene. Store all the fragments in a per pixel linked list, and then for each pixel, do the sorting and the blending. Okay, and this is. Okay, don't need the music. So this is an example that has been done by that. And, okay, I mean, depends on whether you like robots or not, but even if you abstract from that, I think it really looks impressive. Yeah, you see many, many detailed structures inside. So the depth complexity at that scene, depth complexity just means, yeah, how many depth layers are visible in a single pixel. The depth complexity here is at some places is more than 100. And you can see you can change the alpha values on the fly, yeah, and just make parts more transparent, less transparent, and change these things on the fly. So this runs at whatever, I think 100 frames per second. So yeah, really per frame, all the fragments are gathered and are sorted and blended. Yeah, so it's amazing, a lot of work, but yeah. Since everything is so nicely parallelizable, it works interactively. Okay, now colors are changed and so on. Okay. Yeah, so that's a very interesting thing. And as I said, not only for blending it is interesting because it allows us to really store per pixel all the geometry information along or within that pixel. And other interesting effects can be used for that, depth of field and whatever. Yeah? So there are several applications for that. Okay, but this really now brings us far away from computer graphics basics. I just wanted to show and show you that we can do more than just keeping the frontmost fragment and showing that, like the standard set buffer does. Yeah, we can go much further here. Okay. Are there any questions on this? None? Okay. So, if this is not the case, I would like to start with a new chapter, which is a bigger one now, and I think also a very interesting one, both from a practical point of view, but also from a theoretical point of view, and that is texture mapping. And I guess most of you know what texture mapping is. The idea is, yeah, shown nicely in this image, I think, it's a bit like wallpaper. Yeah, the objects that we had up to now are polygonal meshes. We are able to define materials for these meshes and then do a lighting computation, so we see highlights, etc., on the object, and we see a shading. But what we are missing on these objects is fine visual detail. Yeah? And now the idea of texture mapping is exactly like here, putting wallpaper onto an otherwise white wall. Yeah, if we have a white wall, we can do lighting, so we see shading on the wall. If it's glossy, we see highlights. But with texture mapping, now we also apply images to these objects. And these images are called textures, and we kind of glue them onto our object. Yeah, so I will first describe, that's what I will do today, essentially, and then we'll describe how this is done in detail and how also such textures can be computed. We cannot only take photographs or something like that, but to compute these textures with pieces of code, interesting possibilities, and then we'll explain how these textures are then applied to the objects. Yeah, so again, an example, if we want to render a house, yeah, we typically describe the walls of that house as large polygons, yeah, ideally, because this is few geometry and simple to render. We know how to do that efficiently. But then the wall looks boring, yeah? It's just has a uniform color. And the idea of texture mapping now is that we take such a texture that contains, or maybe a photograph of a brick wall, and we just glue that picture onto our larger polygon. Yeah? And the alternative, of course, would be, or the visually probably best solution would be, to really try to model the surface structure of this wall, yeah, so that we have a very very small triangles that really contain the structure of such a wall, and here the mortar between the bricks and so on. Then we have lots of geometry, millions of triangles. This would deliver a wonderful image of that wall, but of course that would be extremely expensive. So the easier solution is just take a photograph and glue it onto it. Yeah? So that's the idea of texture mapping. It's very, very old. Has been first proposed by Ed Catmull, who's one of the bosses of Disney, meanwhile, and has been extended by Jim Blinn. And yeah, these are very old pictures, but I think they show pretty well what we want to achieve. So this is the state of the art as we know it right now. We have objects. We can do lighting on these objects and shading. So this is with Phong shading, I would guess. So we see nice highlights. Yeah, but nevertheless, in particular, the wall here in the back looks very boring. And you might imagine that this is probably a picture here at the wall, but it's right now it's just black. And now by applying textures, yeah, we can make that visually much richer. So the floor, for instance, yeah, is to the floor, a wood texture has been applied. That one is a mirror, which is not really a texture. And then we have textures here on these objects, yeah, to make them just visually more interesting. Okay. So this is what we want to achieve. So what are these textures? Essentially, these textures are images, yeah, but it doesn't have to be images you photograph or so. More general, we could say that these textures are functions that, for every point on an object, deliver a color. In the simplest case, yeah. So it's a way that when I render, for instance, this cone here, for every point on the cone, I ask the texture, what is your color at that point? And it says, here it says, I'm blue, and here it says, I'm golden, and here at the boundary, it says, I'm black. Yeah? And here for the Mona Lisa, at the nose tip, it says, I'm whatever this color here is. Yeah? Some orange, pinkish color. So it's a function that returns colors depending on the position of an object. And of course, this can be extended. It cannot only be colors. You can also imagine, for instance, a texture that changes the shininess coefficient of the Phong model. Yeah? So parts of your object are very glossy and other parts are less. So that's typical. A typical application would be a road surface. Imagine it has rained, so there are part of the road surface where there's water in it and they are very glossy and other parts are already dry. They are not glossy at all. Then you can apply a texture that makes some parts very glossy and others not. Yeah? Then the information stored in the texture is the shininess coefficient. And you can imagine many more. But we will typically only use colors for now. Yeah? But it always stays the same. There are also more complicated textures which are three-dimensional. Essentially, what I described now are two-dimensional textures because they are directly applied on the two-dimensional surface. But you can also imagine three-dimensional textures. And a typical example is wood. Wood or objects of wood are typically, they start with a tree and then you peel off everything that doesn't belong to your object. But the wood structure is kind of three-dimensional. Yeah, and you can just, if you remove, you see these stripes or rings or whatever, and if you remove something, you reveal the wood structure underneath. Yeah? But you can imagine this as a three-dimensional texture. Yeah? And just the part on the surface is red, and this tells us whether you're in the bright or in the dark part of the wood. Okay, but these are already also more complicated things. In the following, we will always look at this 2D part, so we have something like a two-dimensional function that returns a color is what we typically call an image. And this is what we will typically apply. And this is now such an example. We have some three-dimensional object. And we have a picture. And now we want to apply that picture onto that object. We can discuss whether this is a reasonable example. But I think it shows you what we want to achieve. And now you can imagine, how do we essentially applying that image onto that object means that we have to distort that one to stretch it in some regions or to shrink it in others so that it fits on here. Yeah, that's not. Yeah, you have several degrees of freedom to do that, and you could apply it in that direction or upside down. Yeah, how do we define this mapping? How do we define it? Which point of the image is mapped to which position on the surface? Yeah, and these are the typical questions of texture mapping that we will handle in this section. And we will start with that. Not next Tuesday. Yeah, remember that here on top, but next Thursday. Yeah, so in a week. I will continue with that normal time, 12:30. Okay, thank you. See you then. 18 to 19. And in fact, you can now call our secretary, Maria Barotti. And assign times for your exams. And her phone number is 85, that's university, 29919. And then you can get the time for your exam. Okay, thank you. So see you in a week.